My dear listener, I'm in the studio with our executive director of the Futuro Media Group, which produces Latino USA, and Erica Dilde. You say that you've got, there's something you want to talk about.
There is something I want to talk about,
and
Maria.
What would that be?
What I would like to talk about is how podcasts like ours get on the air.
Well, there's a lot of engineers, there's a lot of staff, there's a lot of listeners.
There you go. Our listeners. That's what I'm here to talk about today. Without the support of our listeners donating to their local stations, podcasts like ours and other great podcasts wouldn't be on the air.
So basically, if you're a listener to Latino USA, part of your role as a listener to Latino USA, and by the way, there are many roles that a Latino USA listener has, but one of them is to help out your local station, right?
That's right. And the thing about being a listener to public radio is that you really are the boss. You are the person who keeps great podcasts, breaking news, great stories on the air. So local stations need your support.
Okay. And so what does that mean, Erica? How should they do that?
One way our listeners can help keep great stories on the air is by going to donate.npr.org/Latino and making a contribution. Again, that is donate.npr.org/Latino.
All right. So that's a little task for all of you. Thanks so much.
Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Antonia Cerejido. I'm in for La Jefa, Maria Hinojosa. Eric Reese grew up in Modesto, California, only 2 hours away from Palo Alto. But his first day working in Silicon Valley, he felt like he traveled to a different country.
It was like a very different language. And what I mean by that is like, you know, it's like I heard terms that I never heard of before, like, make sure you BCC this guy, or don't forget to circle back, reply all. I'm like, what does this mean? You know, it was like its own language that I had to learn.
Obviously, terms like reply all aren't tech industry specific. They're just general office terms. But Eric's parents came from Mexico to work as migrant field workers, so he didn't grow up knowing about office culture, but he soon figured it all out.
And I've been involved in the tech space for, you know, almost 5 years.
Eric has worked in marketing and sales at a bunch of different companies, including Waze and Google. And as one of the few Latinos in tech, he's thought a lot about tech's quote-unquote diversity problem. And so he decided to write about it.
So the title of the article is, you know, I'm a Latino in tech, and I think the diversity conversation is broken.
He wrote the article because he felt his experience wasn't being reflected in the diversity conversation. According to Eric, before we can solve the diversity problem, we need to define it. His article, which was published on the website Observer, starts with a description of a scene from Anchorman, the popular 2004 comedy starring Will Ferrell.
And so there's a funny scene where the Channel 5 news team gets brought into a room and Ed Harkin, the manager of the station, you know, tells everyone that he has a big announcement that, you know, there's a big push for diversity and there's going to be changes to the station. And then Champ, one of the main characters, he says,
"What in the hell's diversity?"
And Ron tries to answer because, you know, Ron thinks he's super smart.
"Well, I could be wrong, but I believe diversity is an old, old wooden ship that was used during the Civil War."
And I thought that just was hilarious because he was so serious about it, but completely wrong, obviously. And, you know, it's just something that I didn't really think about in the context of the current narrative around diversity and race until I was kind of putting this together. And I was like, we really still have no idea what diversity is.
Eric thinks that diversity is talked about too simplistically.
We apply these big, broad terms to people, you know, the Hispanic culture or, you know, the Black culture. But we forget that within these terms are like very diverse set of individuals. And, you know, my parents are from Mexico. I grew up speaking Spanish. But I have more in common with someone like Aziz Ansari, who's also the child of immigrants, because we have that shared experience of immigration.
And Eric says that a major issue that he feels is often overlooked is people's socioeconomic background.
Just because, you know, this engineer is African-American and this engineer is Latino and this engineer is white, if they all went to Stanford, you know, is that really diverse?
The truth is, all of the measures that Eric brought up and many more are important factors that contribute to creating a diverse staff. And no matter the measure, gender, race, class, education, Silicon Valley does not reflect the workforce population, something that NPR reporter Alina Selyuk knows all too well.
You know, every year the largest tech companies report their so-called diversity numbers, and it's really starting to feel like Groundhog Day.
Alina is going to be my co-host on this episode. But back to Groundhog Day. Why do these diversity reports feel repetitive?
Let's take Facebook. In 2015, Facebook says, while we've achieved positive movement over the last year, it's clear to all of us we still aren't where we want to be. In 2016, they say, we still have a long way to go, but as we continue to strive for greater change, we are encouraged by positive hiring trends. 2017, they say, we aren't where we'd like to be. And if you look at their numbers, 3% of workers are Black, 5% are Hispanic, up very slightly from last year. Women account for 35%, up from 33% the year before. And that's the quote-unquote positive movement they're feeling encouraged by.
So what's going on with these companies? They say they value diversity. Do they actually care? Should they? Why does diversity in tech matter anyway?
When we think about the companies that skyrocketed and became the most influential presence in the economy over the past 5-10 years, it's the tech industry. They are some of the richest companies in the world. But also on the very fundamental level, these are the companies that are framing our lives, our realities, Google, Facebook, Apple. And so it matters who is at the table making the decisions.
So that's obviously sort of the moral reason that you would want more people at the table is because these companies are changing everyone's lives. So you'd hope that everyone has a say in how their lives are being affected. But then there's also a company profitability side.
Yeah, there was a report in 2015 from McKinsey, which is a major consulting firm. They studied almost 400 public companies, and they found that the companies that had the most diversity when it comes to race, ethnicity, and gender of their staff were significantly more likely to have financial returns higher than their competitors.
So if these companies value diversity, why isn't the tech industry more diverse?
The tech companies often blame something called the pipeline problem.
What's the pipeline problem?
They're basically saying not enough people are out there that are qualified. Not enough people are out there for them to hire. And therefore, that explains why there's not a lot of people of color and not enough women among their staff.
So that's what today's episode is going to be about, the pipeline. Alina and I are going to go through the pipeline and identify the leaks. Where is it that underrepresented groups are dropping out?
And we're going to explore what is being done so that tech can be more inclusive in 10 years, 5 years, and even today.
So, Alina, I traveled to the beginning of the pipeline. I went to downtown LA, where I met a lot of suspicious characters.
What are you dressed as?
A ninja. A skeleton. Cookie.
A cookie.
A bunch of elementary school kids on Halloween. I was visiting an after-school program called Hola to find out what is being done to get kids interested in tech. Hola stands for Heart of Los Angeles, and it's a competitive after-school program that aims to prepare kids for college. 86% of the kids in the program are Latino. The program serves LA's Rampart District, which is the second most densely populated area in the country. 97% of people live in poverty.
Yet despite the challenges, Hola has managed to thrive in the neighborhood for 28 years.
And within Hola, there's a bunch of programs. There's an arts program, and then there's a sports program, but I was there to check out their scientific arts program. It was designed to get kids interested in what's known as STEAM, science, technology, arts, and math, preparing our next generation of tech leaders. The kids get to do all sorts of cool things in the program, like create 3D printing objects, stop motion animation, and also...
We call it Hover.
This is Abraham Orozco. He's been running the scientific arts program for nearly 11 years. He's telling me about their hovercraft class.
Because it's based on a hovercraft, but it's not really a hovercraft. These only have like a single propeller that face forward.
They don't hover, they just go... They just move forward.
Okay. They more like skid along.
He's teaching a class called Hover, where nothing really hovers. Regardless, the middle school kids at Hola have made their own non-hovering crafts, and the point of today's class is to go outside and actually use them.
The hover crafts don't look anything like those hover boards that were making headlines for catching fire.
They look like remote control cars made out of cardboard.
So what are you doing right now?
Well, right now we're going to do the checks. And
so you're trying to get it through the cones?
Yeah.
This is Carlos Vasquez. He's 12 with boundless after-school energy. He's showing me the obstacle course the kids are going to drive their hovercrafts through. Abraham has set up 4 traffic cones and is having the students race around them to see who can do it the fastest. Up first is Carlos.
Oh, wait, I can't control it.
Come back.
After an early crash, he picks himself up and his official time is
51 seconds.
51.
My turn?
Yay! Michaela Onorato has been quietly looking on from the sidelines, waiting her turn. She's tall with a serious and focused gaze.
Have you named your car?
No.
Sorry, focus. It's not helpful.
Woo! Good job. 16 seconds, so you're winning right now.
Wow!
16.36.
Even with this annoying journalist interrupting her concentration, Michaela takes the lead.
It's hard. It looks really hard.
It's easy when you get a hang.
There are around 5 more kids left, and before anyone else has a chance to go, the race is suddenly interrupted.
Why are we moving?
So there's programming that happens in this space as well, so we kind of just took it over.
But so we're never going to know who won, fair and square?
No.
This is one of the class's biggest obstacles as a program, finding space. The dirt field is the only small open sliver in Lafayette Park where there are all sorts of activities going on. Older guys playing basketball, women chatting on tables, people working out and playing frisbee. But beyond busier than normal park activities, the park can be dangerous. The grants assistant at Ola, Sandy Villanueva, gave me a tour of the whole program and she took me to the rec center at the park.
3 weeks ago? There was a shooting here.
In this place?
Right here. It's a really unfortunate. A teenager got shot and he was killed. But it happened like around 3:30.
When the kids were here?
When the kids were here. But it's just like part of what happens in this neighborhood, you know? Like what, just because of poverty levels. And it's been like this for years now. And that's the reason why Ola started and why it's here.
Ola has helped hundreds of kids go to college, and Abraham has seen a handful of his own students go on to successful technical careers.
One of my students that I taught in high school, he went to school for mechanical engineering and electrical engineering, and I was working at an Air Force base. It's hard. I think there's still the jobs that kids want to get are still kind of tied to traditional jobs, like doctors or... So the kids that do well in STEM classes like tend to move away from those fields.
According to Abraham, a lot of these kids don't want to go into jobs where there's any economic risk involved. And often that's the case for startups and other sorts of computer science jobs. And it's even harder to get girls interested in tech. Not that they shy away from using technology. A couple of girls are sitting close by looking down at their phones.
I think they're like doing Snapchat.
Earlier, I had asked Abraham about how many girls are in the scientific arts program.
Middle school, I know middle school and elementary tend to be a little bit more girl heavy, but high school is definitely not. Like, we only have 2 girls out of 13 in high school.
The way Ola works is that the high schoolers can choose what programs they want to be in, but elementary school and middle school kids do not. So I asked the Snapchatting girls if they chose to be in the scientific arts class.
No.
Like, definitely not. So, like, next year, would you want to do something like this again?
Yes.
Okay.
Looking at their faces, though, I don't know if I'm so convinced. Up next, we dive deeper into the pipeline and see what is being done to get more girls into tech. That's coming up on Latino USA. No te me vayas. Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Antonia Cerejido in for María Hinojosa. and I'm joined by my co-host for this hour, NPR's All Tech Considered blog host, Alina Selyuk. So, Alina, when we had left off, I had just visited an after-school program in downtown LA that is trying to get more kids interested in tech. And what they found was that while there was a lot of girl participation in elementary school and middle school, by high school, girls are opting out of the program.
And this is one of the pipeline's clear leaks. And if we look at the numbers down the line, women make up nearly half of the workforce, and yet they only make up around a third of tech industry workers.
So I wanted to find out how women who are already into tech first got interested. And I found out about this Slack group. How would you describe Slack?
Slack is like a private chat room.
So there was a Slack group called Tequería, which is like cute because it's a joke on taquería. It's like, do you get it? and it was all for Latinos who are in tech. And so I joined the Slack group and I asked, who in this group is a woman and how were you interested in tech? And a surprising number of women said,
MySpace was, it was around like 2005 to like 2010 when it was really popular.
This is Dalia Aicidu. She's currently a student at San Jose State and wants to be a UX designer, which basically means that she wants to design how sites and apps look and how they interact with people. But she first got into coding 10 years ago on MySpace.
You know, kids used it to connect with their friends and connect with other people.
Oh my God. I recently rediscovered my MySpace page. It is a really stressful experience. It was black background, very dark, and a lot of really moody music.
For the uninitiated, MySpace was a form of social media that was popular before Facebook. And at least in Southern California, where both Dalia and I are from, MySpace was really popular within a group of kids called Scenesters.
It's like a weird in-between phase between like emo and I don't know what else.
It's like emo with color.
Very colorful. Big hair when people like cut their hair really short at the top with layers. Teased. It was very teased. And they usually had like some color highlights.
It was also associated to this like really whiny style of music, like with bands like My Chemical Romance.
Which was my top five for a short period of time.
You loved My Chemical Romance?
I secretly still do, even though that's probably another thing I shouldn't be admitting in public. This band called Rasmus, very similar, and the dude had raven hair, as in he had an actual raven in his hair.
No.
Yes, he was my favorite for a little while.
That is the most emo thing I've ever heard in my entire life.
I wasn't even emo.
It was a sign of the times.
It was a period in everyone's life, if you're in your late 20s right now.
But so all of this, which some people are like, how is this at all related to tech? The reason this is related to tech is that in order to make your MySpace look cool, you had to know like basic HTML. Because you would have to go into your source code of the back of the page and you could change the colors, you can make them smaller. And Dalia was the queen of making her profile look super cool.
I went through phases with themes. So once I found out that I could like scan drawings and stuff, I would try doing that. And then I went through a phase where I would do like color block. And then I would change like the color scheme every, literally every day probably, because I was 12. I had nothing else to do.
After high school, Dalia made her own online shop where she sold things like band pins and earrings. And that's when her MySpace skills came in handy.
I was doing the website and there was like things that would bug me where like, you know, the margin was too big on some areas. So I started to just go into the code. I started to see a lot of the HTML and like CSS that I had learned before. And then from then, I just started picking up JavaScript. That gave me a lot more confidence in like being able to pick up coding.
It's true that in general, tech has become more user-friendly, which ironically has sort of made it less accessible. For instance, we all use Facebook, even grandparents know how to use it, but that doesn't mean that we understand the commands and coding that make Facebook happen.
And so there's this gap between girls using technology. 80% of girls are on social media, according to the Pew Research Center, and the girls seeing themselves as the creators of that technology.
No, and that's the interesting thing. The number of women getting bachelor's degrees in math and computer science sort of peaked in the 80s, and the numbers have been declining since then. Our friends over at NPR's Planet Money podcast actually looked into this, and what they found is that in 1984, the computer started to be marketed specifically to boys as a toy.
So now there's a sort of pushback to what happened in the 80s, and people in the tech industry are trying to market tech to girls. A couple years ago, I went to a conference that was being held at the Google headquarters in DC, and they were brainstorming ways to get Latinas interested in tech. And I was surprised actually by like how hot the debate got. One of the suggested ideas was teaching girls to code through having them do the lighting at their own quinceañera. And a lot of the Latina engineers fought back. They were like, this is such a stereotypical way of treating girls and of treating this issue. And actually, Alina, you had a story on All Tech Considered about a product that sort of walked that line.
Yeah, a couple of years ago, my colleague wrote a story about a device called the Nailbot. It's a printer that connects to a smartphone and prints images on nails. And the question we asked at the time was, could this Nailbot be a gateway for girls to tech?
Did people also get mad about the Nailbot?
Quite a bit. A lot of people were saying, like, how is a beauty product going to get girls into tech? Isn't there something more substantive for a tech startup focused on girls to pursue?
And a lot of people look at this and they're like, this is very fluffy, Pri. But it's not fluffy. We won serious awards. We were TechCrunch Disrupt Battlefield finalists. We were...
That's Nailbot inventor Pri Walia. I called her recently to ask her about the Nailbot, and Pri lists off a whole bunch of accolades that she and her company, Pri Madonna, received, and several of them are in robotics competitions.
And I still get labeled, this is really fluffy, Pri. Right?
And to that question, can a nail art printer get girls into tech? She says, honestly, it may not. But what she's focused on is bridging that gap between girls being consumers and becoming creators.
You know, when I talk about this product and the evolution of going from an idea to a prototype, I mean, you're showing the evolution of a product and how you use technology to improve that product for the consumer.
Pri says her company is working with some schools and Girl Scouts to teach girls how to build their own printers, code their own designs.
You can wear a short skirt and wear a tiara and still hack hardware. That's okay.
And to diversity advocate Del Medina, that's the crux of the issue with pink tech. What's inside it? What does it actually let girls do?
There's a difference between wanting to celebrate your femininity and shrinking and pinking something.
Del now works for Code 2040, a nonprofit focused on diversity among tech engineers. Before that, she ran a Latina-focused accelerator. And long before that, she was the only girl in an after-school computer club. And she offers a story that highlights the difference between making technology pink and making it with women actually in mind.
There was a moment in which I believe it was HP came out with a computer, and it was very small. It was very pink. It wasn't very useful. It didn't have a lot of RAM. It didn't have, which means a lot of memory or a lot of processing power. It was very expensive. And I felt so insulted because I didn't mind the fact that it was smaller because I have small hands and it's helpful to have a smaller keyboard so that I don't get carpal tunnel. But it was the fact that the computer itself had so little processing power, so little memory, so little software that would be helpful to me. And on top of that, it was a really ugly pink. Like, if you're going to choose a pink, choose a nice one.
So the conversation about how to target girls can get kind of thorny.
That's true. But I spoke to Andrea Gwendelman, the creator of Be Visible, which is a social media platform to connect Latinos in tech. And she told me that there's one thing that definitely has been effective in getting more girls and women into tech.
There's one thing that works, and I think that is the only thing that works, is mentorship, is seeing role models, is seeing others doing it.
So our producer, Jeannie Montalvo, wanted to see mentorship in action.
Yes, I did.
So Jeannie, who did you reach out to?
Well, I knew about this program called Girls Who Code, and it's a nonprofit. They work to close the gender gap in the tech sector and pretty much teach girls and only girls to code. They run these summer workshops at different tech companies, and I met a young woman who went to one of them. Her name is Jasmine Fernandez, and she spent the summer of 2014 doing one of these workshops at Facebook headquarters in Menlo Park.
So tell me a little bit more about Jasmine.
Jasmine is from downtown Oakland, California. She was raised by a single mom, and that was super important in shaping her thoughts and kind of like what women can and can't do.
I was raised by basically women. It was my mom, my two sisters. My mom had to work. She had to fix the car when she couldn't, like, it wasn't working and she couldn't take me to school.
When Jasmine was a senior in high school, her friend actually forced her to do the application for Girls Who Code. And she got accepted. But when she found out that she was going to Facebook, she admits that she was kind of intimidated.
I was excited, but mostly really, really scared. Because when I went, there was just a lot of... How do I say this? There was just a lot of...
There weren't very many people that looked like you, huh?
Yes.
So the other voice you heard there just a moment ago, that's Raquel Velez. She's Jasmine's mentor. I interviewed them together. Raquel is the engineering manager at a software company called NPM. Jasmine heard her give a talk at Facebook, and she made a huge impression on her. Up until that point, Jasmine didn't even think Latinas could get jobs at big tech companies. But Raquel showed her it was possible.
One of my favorite quotes ever is, you can't be it if you can't see it, which basically says, if you don't see somebody doing a job, you don't ever think that you yourself could do that thing.
So Jasmine and Raquel started to write to each other, and eventually a mentorship evolved. Jasmine's at San Francisco State now. Her time at Girls Who Code really inspired her to study computer science. So I asked her, what is it like to be one of the few women in the program? And she told me this story about this thing that happened in one of her classes, where this guy basically said that girls couldn't code.
And that got me upset because I was there, and I told him, I'm here for a reason. Like, I'm doing the same thing that you're doing, and I'm pretty sure I have a better grade than you. And it's always going to be a struggle, I think. There's always going to be that person that's going to put you down. But that's why you have to, like, kind of go around it or ignore them.
Jeannie, you're not just a producer here at Latino USA. You're also the sound engineer. When you hear things like this, like, do you relate?
Oh, absolutely. I've been there more than once. I feel like when you're a woman in any tech field, it's really exhausting to just stand up for yourself in a room full of men. I'm always stuck with this inner struggle of, yes, I can do this, versus I am really, really tired of proving that I can do this. Mentorship has always been really important to me. So when you have those moments of doubt, you can just turn to somebody and they're going to say, hey, it's going to get better. Jasmine's mentor, Raquel, puts it this way.
To be Latina in these industries, you have to work four times as hard, right? Like, it's just simple math. You got to work four times as hard to prove yourself. And that is so frustrating, so frustrating. But that's why you got to surround yourself with people who are like you, who look like you, who act like you, who are in the same fields as you. And, you know, believe me, I have like 25 mentors, and it's the only way that I can make it through because so often I'm the only one.
So Jasmine's in her second year studying computer science, and she kind of finds herself at a crossroads right now. She's not sure she wants to continue the program.
I'm kind of more of like my hands-on. I feel like I'm more interested in building things just because, I don't know, I can't stand being in the computer a little bit like for hours and hours.
I completely understand that, right? I think a lot of times we pressure ourselves into doing, like, if you think of it like as a pendulum, right? Like on one end, like there's the stereotype, like Latinas go into nursing or they go into cooking and cleaning or whatever. And then like you can push, like you can be like, I'm going to do so not that thing. And you'll go completely to the other side. And sometimes you end up pushing yourself into a direction that isn't really what you want still. If computer science is the way for you, then do computer science. If it's not the right way for you, that's okay too. You got to be the best at whatever it is that you decide to do. And that, believe me, will take you so, so, so far. Like, you're no idiot, hon.
So, Jeannie, why do you think mentorship matters?
I just kind of feel that we all go through points of doubt and frustration, and having someone there that can say, you got this, can make all the difference of whether you continue or not. In Jasmine's case, if she decides to continue with computer science or not, she found a mentor. Here's Raquel again.
I like to think about it as I walked in the back door so that I could open the front door for everybody else. You know, being the pioneer, being the first one through is hard. It's asking a lot, but you make it easier for every person who comes in after you.
It'll be interesting to see whether Jasmine ends up staying in the pipeline. College is one of the places where people start doubting their future in tech.
Yeah, Dahlia, the MySpace layout master, she's also trying to figure out her next steps. Now you're not studying computer science.
I'm not.
Dahlia is studying communications. She thinks it's a little too late to change her major, but she has a plan.
I want to do a boot camp, which in Silicon Valley, there's so many.
A boot camp is an intense program that normally lasts around 6 weeks where people can jumpstart their coding career.
I really want to do, there's one called Hack Reactor that I'm applying to, mostly because they offer a pretty good scholarship and they are one of the best ones right now.
And like, how expensive is a boot camp?
They range. So I've seen some lately that are from, I think, from 11,000 to 17.
It's tricky to determine the effects boot camps have on bringing more diversity to Silicon Valley because there are so many and they are so different. But they are typically cheaper than getting a computer science degree, even if they're not cheap. And they are often considered less prestigious than an actual degree.
But it is hard to get hired after a boot camp because you don't have like the computer science education and you also don't have the experience.
And also Dahlia sometimes just feels overwhelmed by the whole industry.
It's hard to not doubt yourself when you hear about like the struggles of like everyone who's trying to get in tech.
Yeah.
Like even my boyfriend who like graduated with computer science, it took him 5 months to find a job. It was just like interview after interview and, you know, rejection after rejection. So it's definitely like, you're definitely like, am I cut out for this?
In general, tech is a hard field to get into. It's highly competitive and constantly changing. It's only been 10 years since Dahlia was a MySpace queen, but already technology and people's attitude towards technology have changed a lot. Dahlia is a part-time nanny, and she has her own theory as to why younger girls aren't that interested in learning to code.
When I was growing up, it was like my parents didn't want me to be on the computer most of the time. So I think it was like my rebellion toward them was kind of like getting into code and being on the computer. Nowadays, I think that coding has been seen as something that is beneficial. A lot of parents like encourage their kids. Kids rebel against that.
Like now that their parents want them to code, they're not interested in it anymore.
Yeah, because like as a nanny, like my kids go to like a camp during the summer where they learn how to code. And they're just like, yeah, but I don't really think I want to do that.
Really?
Yeah, and they're like, my parents just want me to learn because they think it's a good job to get. I was just like, wow, I would have loved to like go to camps when I was a kid for coding.
Up next, we get to the end of the pipeline. What happens to the people who don't fall through the cracks? No te vayas.
Hey, everyone. So I'm sitting here in our little studio with our executive director of Futuro Media, and her name is Erica Dilde. And Erica says, well, so what? You've got some news for us, Erica. What's this about?
I have something I want to share with you, Maria.
Okay.
I wanted to take a little bit of time to talk about one of the many reasons why our listeners are so important.
Okay. Well, I love all of our listeners, every single one of them. Okay. Tell me more.
Okay, well, do you know how podcasts like Latino USA are able to connect you to a world of ideas and issues?
Well, we do it because we open up people's minds, and from there they just take it to the next level. But I have a feeling I'm missing something.
Well, there's a little something in between. Before the mind, there's actually your local station, who is investing in local journalism and podcast, and that's done with the support of listeners like ours.
Right. And when we do this kind of journalism, it really, you know, it really brings all of us much closer. And your local station is really part of the big story of connecting us all to each other.
That's right. And if we want to keep these stories and connections and conversations going, listeners like ours have to donate to their local stations. And even better, if you donate and then want to share why you did, mark hashtag WhyPublicRadio and let us know why it's so important to you.
Thanks so much.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Antonia Cerejido, in for María Hinojosa. I'm joined by my co-host, Alina Selyuk. So far in this episode, we've been going through the so-called pipeline, looking at what's being done to bring more women, people of color, and people from a lower socioeconomic status into tech.
We've gone through elementary school, middle school, high school, college, but when we get to the end of the pipeline, it runs straight into a wall.
Wait, a wall?
So here's the thing about the end of the pipeline. Even if underrepresented groups get all the way through it, they often struggle to get hired and stay hired.
So it's not just a pipeline issue.
And it's not just the technical jobs, but all executive jobs. Silicon Valley is a boys' club, and mainly a white boys' club. So their networks tend to stay white and male.
The pipeline is a problem, but the bigger problem today, I would say, is the recruiting process, the hiring barriers, and also the inclusion aspects.
This is Ellen Pao, the former CEO of Reddit and the founder of Project Include, a nonprofit dedicated to increasing diversity in tech.
We would love to see companies really take a look at, are their interviewing processes actually causing women and potentially other groups to drop out disproportionately?
We wanted to see if any companies had considered this kind of self-aware approach. So Latino USA producer Noam Hassenfeld and I found two companies that are actively thinking about diversity.
And Ellen Pao is actually an investor in one of these companies, which is called Atypica. For the record, Atypica is partially funded by KPOR Capital, the investment arm of the KPOR Center for Social Impact, which is among Latino USA's financial supporters. We looked at Atypica because there's an interesting story there, not because of the connection to KPOR. Now, Atypica's founder is Laura Gomez, a former manager at Twitter, and she's one of a very small number of Latina founders.
In an area where it's really hard, less than 1% of all venture capital goes towards Hispanic, much less women.
Laura has spent much of her career in the tech sector. She saw firsthand how hard it was to be both a woman and Latina, and she also saw how businesses were often more successful when they were more diverse. So she responded directly to Ellen Pao's challenge to fix the hiring barrier at the end of the pipeline.
What we do is take artificial intelligence to read those resumes in a way that is structured to understand what their needs are for the company.
By designing a computer program to read resumes rather than letting managers do it, Atypica helps companies avoid a whole lot of potential problems, mainly those of bias in hiring. Here's Laura again.
For a long while still, tech has followed pattern matching. Did you go to school? Can you code?
Pattern matching is basically tech speak for stereotyping.
Pattern matching sometimes has a tendency to go along with past employers or universities, or even sometimes biases in the name.
So if you have a common Latino last name, or if you go to school outside the highest rated colleges, a manager may automatically assume you're unqualified. Atypica, though, isn't the first company to create a computer program for hiring. Big companies like Google use computer programs to sift through resumes, but Laura says that might not be enough to ensure that their hiring process is unbiased. Because if those seemingly unbiased computer programs
are created with the mentality that they should reflect whatever industry or information you have, then they're just going to start learning the same information and biases that are reflected in their data.
In other words, we sometimes think that computers will just fix our problems, but we forget that computers are built by people, people who often have the very biases these programs are trying to fix. If a program is built by biased people, the program will just end up reflecting those biases on a wider scale. And Atypica has designed its program from the ground up explicitly to avoid these types of biases. supposedly.
So does a Typicus program work? Is it actually a magic bullet to get more women, for example, hired for tech jobs?
Well, we don't really know. Slack, one of the companies Atypica works with, has pretty good diversity numbers for the tech industry. Their latest report revealed that 43% of their managers identify as women, but that report was before their relationship with Atypica started. And Atypica itself hasn't published any results of their program. Despite repeated requests, we couldn't get Laura or her clients to talk to us about how well the program has worked.
So for now, the jury is still out. Meanwhile, in Chicago, another company has also focused on diversity by zeroing in on its own staff and without any fancy computer programs.
We're not using quotas, right? We're not saying we need this next person in this role to fit a certain demographic. But when we are looking to hire people, we do understand that having a diverse perspective will help our team.
That's Ayo Jimmo. He's the chief technology officer at a company called Upturnative. It's basically an app that lets people do their own eye exams. And in a lot of ways, Upturnative is a pretty typical startup, but it does not look like one. Here's Ayo's colleague, Gerald Palmer.
When I walked into Upturnative, I saw the diversity and I was like, wow, what a breath of fresh air. A startup that looks like this, when my last startup was like, I was one of two Black people there, it makes a difference. I interviewed at several places where I walked in and I said, I do not want to be the only Black guy again. I'm taking myself out of the pool for this job.
Upturnative has built a seriously diverse team. Ayo, the CTO, and Gerald, who runs patient support, are both African-American. One of the co-founders is Chinese-Canadian. There are three Latino staffers. You might think Upturnative knows something that others in the industry don't. But talking to them, it becomes clear that while their thinking may be different, they're not really doing anything that special. Here's CTO Ayo.
We've always been a team that has sought out diversity of all types, and not through any types of quotas or anything like that, but just because we understand that it improves our ability to get a variety of opinions on all topics, not just the perspectives of, you know, one person or one specific demographic.
So they still operate similarly to many Silicon Valley companies. They rely on employees to refer friends or former colleagues for job openings. But they get a different result, because from the get-go, their team was not just a bunch of white dudes.
I think it all starts at the beginning, right? So once you start with a culture of diversity, it's easy to continue with that because you have a diverse group of people referring other people.
So we've got Atypica, a tech company with a computer program helping other companies up their diversity, and Upturnative, a company that has focused on increasing its own diversity. But here's where the story gets tricky.
As I'm talking to Ayo at Upturnative, we get to the question of technical jobs in his own company. It's a small team, fewer than a dozen people, and four of them are in top positions. They're senior engineers.
Our senior engineers are really the ones who are guiding the rest of the team, serving as mentors, but then also, you know, some of the core members in terms of implementing on the software platform.
And I'm going to ask you, over those four senior engineers, are any of them women?
Currently, they are not. Our senior engineers, currently all four are men.
And I didn't know this, but around the same time Ayo and I were having this conversation, Noam, you had a similar one with Laura at Atypica.
Yeah, I looked at Atypica's list of employees, and other than Laura, its founder, Atypica only has one woman employee. The company devoted to increasing diversity throughout the tech sector employs just one woman other than its founder.
I think about it constantly.
When I asked her to explain why she employs so few women, she said that most women who apply do so as junior engineers, and that's not enough experience for her company.
They're not a fit for Atypica because we right now have mostly senior engineers.
Honestly, it's a little hard to get past this. Laura says she hasn't hired more women because they don't have enough experience. Basically, she's making the pipeline argument that there aren't enough qualified women to hire. But her whole company is founded on the idea that the problem isn't the pipeline.
We don't think it's a pipeline issue. Like, there's still more female engineers than the roles that they're being given.
Ayo over at Upturnative says he had a similar experience hiring senior engineers. Only a few women applied, and they simply didn't have the right experience. But he says the pipeline problem is a fact. The shortage of qualified women and people of color in tech is real. And his diagnosis is that people self-select. They simply don't want to pursue careers that are stacked against them. They need mentors, role models, success stories of others who are like them. And I just kept wondering, who's responsible for breaking the cycle, for creating these role models?
Do you think that part of that responsibility is on you, say, to really go out of your way to spend extra time and find that senior engineer, or to spend extra time and promote your existing junior engineer into a senior engineering position so she can become that person?
I don't think, you know, that's anyone's, you know, responsibility. I think it's something, you know, it's a self-imposed responsibility. I don't think it's a societal responsibility. You know, people can choose to move along in their careers as they see fit, but people who do care about seeing others like them succeed, or seeing there being no barriers to success, if you do truly believe in that, I think it is your responsibility.
Well, so for you personally, do you think it's your responsibility?
That's a hard one, right? I do believe in, you know, reducing barriers. And I do believe I have a responsibility, and I put in the time that I have to do that. At the same time, I have a responsibility to my company, to my team, to myself, to my family. So it definitely does have to be balanced.
So it's almost like there are two competing impulses here: improve gender equity or ensure the success of your business. You might not think these values are in conflict, but even the companies who are better on diversity seem to think they are.
In a way, this push for diversity in tech is still so new that it's sort of treated as a cause or a mission. And fighting for a cause and running a business aren't the same thing.
If you think about Lauda, at the end of the day, she didn't found Atypica to heal Silicon Valley's diversity problem. She founded a company she thought could fill a market need.
There is a part of me that says, let me show, but I have to put my business first and foremost.
So here's the messy reality. Two companies that are front runners on tech diversity get high marks for racially diverse teams, yet still struggle with gender equity.
And we've actually discovered a similar situation at other companies that say they put diversity first, like a boot camp that pushes to recruit women but hires all male instructors.
Lauda and Ayo both point out that their teams are tiny, so they aren't hiring that many people. But at the big companies, the problem is even harder to overcome. It's like steering a massive ship. Turning it just a few degrees takes a major concerted effort.
And it's interesting to see how different companies are tackling the issue. Slowly, some of them have started to put diverse hiring in quantifiable terms. The goals aren't lofty, but at least they're specific, measurable, public. They are someone's responsibility. For example, Twitter has a specific percentage target for women engineers, and Intel has a goal of having at least 45% of its new hires be women or underrepresented groups.
This episode originally aired in 2016, so here's a quick update a year down the line. Intel did hit their goal of having 45% of new hires be women or underrepresented groups. Atypica still hasn't published results of their program, and when I went to their website to see if they had hired any more women, I found that they had removed their list of staff from the site. I reached out to Lauda, and she declined to comment. But one of the companies Atypica works with, Slack, has shown improvement in 2017. Their percentage of women employees has stayed the same over the last year, but their percentage of women managers has gone up from 43 to 48%.
And here's an update from Alternative. A big one is that Gerald Palmer has switched jobs since the episode first aired, so he actually does not work at Alternative anymore. In terms of the situation inside Alternative, the company also declined to provide an update, but on their website we saw that they now have a female executive. She's been hired as the chief product officer.
More broadly, 2017 has seen some major developments in the conversation around diversity in tech. Former Google engineer James Damore wrote a memo called Google's Ideological Echo Chamber, in which he claimed that the reason there are fewer women in tech is at least partially due to biology. Damore was then fired by Google.
In a note to Google employees, Google's CEO Sundar Pichai wrote this: "To suggest a group of our colleagues have traits that make them less biologically suited to that work is offensive and not okay."
Then there was a series of sexual harassment cases that have led to the retirement of many Silicon Valley leaders.
Travis Kalanick, the co-founder of Uber, resigned as CEO after sexual harassment allegations. Mike Cagney, the head of social finance, also known as SoFi, resigned after a harassment scandal. And Dave McClure, head of the incubator 500 Startups, resigned, writing a blog post entitled, "I am a creep, I am sorry."
Aarti Shahani, technology reporter for NPR, says that things are starting to change.
It's a sign that people are noticing things that would have been considered acceptable behavior maybe a couple decades ago or a decade ago are now really being brought into question, and a lot of women are stepping up and speaking out.
But Aarti is noticing pushback as well. She says that an investor told her that she's now seeing a new pattern.
Startups run by men who say, wow, there's so much of this sexual harassment and complaining stuff going on. We just don't want to hire women. We don't want to do it because it just opens us up to liability.
There needs to be pressure on these startups.
Short of having pressure, real pressure, to make sure you're inclusive, you might just shut the doors tighter.
And this pressure can come from investors. As a startup founder,
you listen a whole lot to who you're getting money from. And so what I've observed is a lot more scrutinizing.
She points to specific investment firms, which basically say,
you have to make this pledge. You have to commit to diversity and inclusion goals.
Sure, progress is moving slowly, but Aarti says the shift is real.
There has been a palpable shift here where people feel like they're being watched and feel like they have to be accountable in ways that privately wealthy, rich investors didn't quite feel before.
Ultimately, holding companies accountable for sexual harassment and for hiring goals will allow more kinds of people to enter and stay in the tech field. And crucially, many economists point out that's the major challenge for the future of America. The economy of the future is one where almost everyone has to interact with computers and code.
According to Deldel Medina, who you heard from earlier in the show complaining about the pink computer, the way to make sure America isn't left behind is by bringing more people into the tech field as it stands.
We're going to have a jobs deficit that's so huge that if we do not fill it, we are going to have severe economic consequences. And women and everybody who's currently underrepresented in the tech industry has to gain those skill sets, because otherwise it will not go well for any of us.
If we zoom out, it becomes clear that there is still a pipeline problem. And those leaks need to be patched up in order for the tech industry to become more inclusive. Our economy could depend on it. That's our show for today. This episode of Latino USA was produced by me, Antonia Cerejido, my co-host for this hour, NPR's Alina Selyuk, Nadia Raymond, Marlon Bishop, Jeannie Montalvo, Noam Hassenfeld, Fernanda Chavarri, Julia Shu, and Zakia Gibbons. Special thanks to Lucia Benavides. Our engineer and music editor is Cornelius McMoyler. Our production manager is Natalia Fiedelholtz. And if you enjoyed the music you heard on this episode and want to learn more, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. Our host and executive producer is Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the Winecoat Foundation, supporting efforts that strengthen and enrich culture, community, and the natural environment. The New York Women's Foundation, funding women leaders that build solutions in their communities and celebrating 30 years of radical generosity. And by funds granted from the Charles H. Revson Foundation. The statements made and views expressed, however, are solely the responsibility of the author.
My very first top eight included the generic founder of MySpace.
Tom. Tom was his name.
Tom.
Yeah. Alina, that's a sad high school.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA.
Well, I think we have this idea of Minnesota nice. Folks that like Minnesota nice say, oh, we're really friendly, people are smiley. But a lot of folks of color and Native folks will tell you Minnesota nice is passive-aggressive racism.
That's next time on Latino USA.